Hello, 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 geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers, and welcome back to Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Before I get into everything, just a couple announcements. sometime in the very near future, me and AK Herrera, who's been on the show, and is also the musical entity known as Entropy in Motion, are putting out a collaborative single, maybe this week, hopefully. But yeah, should be coming soon. It's called Rape by Entropy. Kind of a combination of both of our band names. So yeah, keep an eye out for that. I think it's some pretty fire shit. So yeah, keep an eye out for that. And I wanted to get serious for a moment. In the wake of the school shooting that happened in Texas just this past week, there is real evil out in this world. It's not the monsters I talk about in the movies on this episode, or in these episodes. It's not the stalkers or the slashers. It's us. We're a very real evil. And there's no way, it's not like this evil isn't like a Dracula or a King Kong or whatever the fuck. Pick any monster and put it in that space. It's us, and we can't just, well, we can drive a stake through each other, but that's just fucking murder and isn't going to get us anywhere. But my point is that now is the time when we all need to stand together, put all our fucking petty bullshit aside, and realize that we need to be there for one another. Because we have gone way past the point of no return, and shit's not going to get any better, and it's not going to go back to how it was before. That's just how things are now. And when a tragedy like this happens is when we really need to support one another. Even if it's not someone that was directly involved with that tragedy. We all just need to be there for one another in times like these. Or else more situations like this are going to keep happening. And they will regardless. But maybe if you're friendly to one person, that can stop them from taking out fucking 17 kids that did nothing to anybody and never had the chance to and never will. So think about that next time you feel like being a dick to somebody or you realize that somebody needs help or needs a little cheering up. Just be that person that gives them that help. All right, so enough of the serious shit. So with having taken a break from the normal format of this podcast with the last two episodes, I decided it was time to jump back up on my normal bullshit and continue doing what I do best. So since Memorial Day is on Monday, I thought I'd talk about some movies that dealt with the military. They might not have anything to do with Memorial Day per se, but all these movies, good or bad, all have some kind of connection to the military, or some sort of military branch. So let's kick it right off with 1974's Death Dream.
Descended upon the town. Something corrupt, their drawn curtains, they waited as fear walked in the dead of night.
Hello, this is the police department. Please identify yourself.
Hey, soldier, where you headed? Come on, hop aboard.
What does it say, Daddy?
Dandy.
Is that Andy?
Joanne doesn't even know he's home yet. She'll be so surprised.
But Andy wouldn't kill anybody.
Man came back with something taken with him, something unspeakable.
The movie opens in 1972 during Vietnam, where American soldier Andy Brooks is shot by a sniper and falls to the ground. As he dies, he hears his mother's voice calling out, "Andy, you'll come back. You've got to. You promised." Sometime later, his family receives notice of his death in combat. Andy's father, Charles, and sister, Kathy, begin to grieve, but his mother, Christine, becomes irate and refuses to believe that Andy has died. Meanwhile, a trucker stops at a diner and says he's picked up a hitchhiker who is a soldier. Hours later, in the middle of the night, Andy arrives at the front door of the family house in full uniform, apparently unharmed. The family welcomes him back with joy, concluding the notice of his death was a clerical error. And the father says they thought Andy had died. He replies, "I did." The family laughs, just thinking that this is a joke. In the next few days, Andy displays strange withdrawn behavior, speaking only rarely, dressing in a concealing manner, and spending his days sitting around the house, listless and anemic. At night, though, he becomes inexplicably animated, wandering the town and spending time at the local cemetery. Meanwhile, local police investigate the murder of a local trucker who was found with his throat slashed and his body drained of blood. Charles attempts to confront Christine about Andy's erratic behavior. Christine insists that Charles was too withdrawn and too strict with Andy. Charles counters that Christine made Andy too sensitive by smothering him, and Andy continues to display weird behavior. He attacks a neighborhood boy who attempts to demonstrate his karate skills, and then kills the family dog when it tries to protect the child. Charles witnesses the killing, tells his wife that their son is crazy, and then goes to the bar where he tells his friend, a doctor, what Andy did. Charles then brings the doctor home, and he offers Andy a free checkup. The doctor asks Andy questions related to the truck driver, suspecting him of being the one who killed him. The doctor tells Charles about the truck driver and says he needs to inform the police about the suspicious coincidence of Andy's return. Andy then visits him at his office in the middle of the night, angrily demanding a checkup, but the doctor can't detect a pulse or heartbeat. Andy tells him, "I died for you, Doc. Why shouldn't you return the favor?" He then attacks and kills the doctor with a syringe, then uses it to inject the doctor's blood into his arm. It's clear that Andy is some kind of vampire or zombie who needs the blood of others to reinvigorate his decaying body. The next day, Charles learns that the doctor was killed and becomes convinced his son is responsible for the deaths. When Christine tells him that Andy is on a double date with his high school sweetheart, Joanne, his sister, and his best friend, Bob, Charles gets his gun and goes looking for them. At the drive-in, Andy visibly decays due to lack of blood, and Kathy and Bob briefly leave the car to go get more popcorn. Joanne attempts to strike up a conversation with Andy, but when Andy's decay becomes more visible, he attacks and kills Joanne. Kathy and Bob return to the car to find Andy in a raged frenzy and attacks the two of them. Andy strangles and kills Bob and attempts to run over Kathy with the car. A stranger shoves Kathy to the side and is hit by Andy instead and is killed, and Andy flees in the car before he can inject his victim's blood. Andy returns home where his mother protects him from his father, Charles. Stricken with grief, he commits suicide when he sees the monster his son has become. As Christine is driving Andy away, he is shot twice by the police, and their gunfire sets the car on fire. The police pursuit ends at the graveyard where Andy has been spending his time. They discover his decayed corpse writhing in a shallow grave beneath a tombstone on which Andy had scrawled his own name and the dates of his birth and death. Christine sobs as she tries to cover the corpse with dirt. Her car explodes, and she tells the officers Andy's home. Some boys never come home. And the movie ends. Pretty much an indictment of the Vietnam War. This is a different kind of take on the classic tale of the monkey's paw. If you're looking for right-out action, this isn't the movie for you, because it's a rather slow-moving movie. And not a whole hell of a lot goes on during the first half hour or so. But once it gets going, it really does get going. The acting in it is so-so. It's not horrible, but it's not great. I've talked about a lot worse in previous movies in previous episodes. But there are some pretty fairly creepy shots of Andy in this movie that even creeped me the fuck out. So it's done very well with the lighting and shit like that. It does tend to get a little overly preachy about war and shit like that. But I mean, again, consider the time that this was made in. IMDb gave this a 6.6 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes an 83%, Letterboxd a 3.5 out of 5, and I give it a 3.5 out of 5 as well. Next up, we have 1987's Predator.
We are a rescue team, not assassins. Now, what are we gonna do?
In a part of the world where there are no rules.
We pick up their trailer, the chopper, run them down, grab those hostages before anybody knows we were there. What do you mean we?
Deep in the jungle, where nothing that lives is safe. You lose it here, you're in a world of hurt.
Showtime, Jim. Knock, knock.
An elite rescue squad.
You're bleeding, man. I ain't got time to bleed.
Is being led by the ultimate warrior.
We need the best. That's why you're here.
But now,
what's got Billy so spooked?
There's something out there waiting for us. And it ain't no man. They're up against the ultimate enemy.
Holy mother God.
Nothing like it has ever been on Earth before.
She says the jungle just came alive and took it.
We cannot see it.
No blood, no bodies. We hear nothing.
But it sees the heat of our bodies and the heat of our fear.
Whatever it is out there killed Hopper. And now it wants us.
It kills for pleasure.
He was skinned alive!
It hunts for sport.
He's killing us one at a time.
We're all gonna die.
But this time, it's picked the wrong man to hunt.
If it bleeds, we can kill it.
Predator. The hunt begins Friday, June 12th at theaters everywhere.
if you're listening to this podcast, I probably really shouldn't have to give a rundown of this movie because I'm sure everyone and their grandmother has seen it. But if you haven't, for shame. But if you, but again, if you haven't, I'll give the rundown anyway. The movie opens with an alien spacecraft deploying a shuttle to Earth. Meanwhile, Vietnam War veteran Major Alan Dutch Schaefer and his military rescue team, consisting of Mac, Poncho, Blaine, Billy, and Hawkins, are tasked with rescuing a foreign cabinet minister and his aide from insurgents. CIA officer Al Dillon, a Vietnam War buddy of Dutch's, is assigned to accompany the team over Dutch's objections. While en route, the team discovers the wreckage of a helicopter and three skinned corpses. Dutch identifies them as Green Berets that he knew and becomes suspicious of Dillon's intentions. The team reaches a guerrilla camp and witnesses the execution of a hostage. They then mount an attack, killing the rebels and several Soviet intelligence officers. Dutch then confronts Dillon, who reveals their true mission was to stop a planned Soviet-backed invasion and that the CIA sent the Green Berets weeks earlier for the same mission. The only surviving guerrilla, Anna, is captured. Learning that more rebels are coming, the team must trek to the extraction point. They are, however, being followed by a presence that uses a cloaking device and tracks them by thermal imaging. A spooked Billy does see it, while Anna attempts an escape. Hawkins manages to catch her, but the creature attacks and kills him while sparing Anna. Dutch organizes a search party, but Blaine is killed by the creature's plasma cannon, and enraged, Mac incites everyone to fire their weapon into the jungle, unknowingly wounding the creature. As the creature mends itself, the commandos regroup and realize they are being hunted. Dillon believes only two or three gorillas are responsible, but Billy is adamant that their pursuer is not human. They make camp for the night and set traps, which are triggered by a wild boar. And in the confusion, Mac kills it while the creature steals Blaine's body. Dutch later realizes that their enemy uses the trees to travel and frees Anna, who states that her people had seen similarly mutilated bodies in the past. Excuse me. Next day, the group constructs a net trap and the creature is captured, but it escapes and Poncho is injured. Mac and Dillon pursue it, but are outmaneuvered and killed. As the survivors flee, Billy stays behind to fight the creature, giving the others time to escape. Billy is killed, and the creature follows the survivors and kills Poncho. Dutch realizes it does not attack unarmed individuals, and he tells the unarmed Anna to get to the chopper at the extraction point. Dutch attempts to distract the creature by fleeing, but it is followed to a muddy riverbank, where Dutch emerges from the water covered in mud to stop the predator's heat sensors. The creature, of course, fails to see him and leaves to collect trophies from the others. Dutch realizes that the creature hunts by using thermal imaging technology to defeat body heat and the cool mud provided camouflage. He crafts makeshift traps and weapons and lures the creature out at night with the war cry and torch. He lightly injures the creature and disables its cloaking device, and the creature fires wildly into the forest. Dutch escapes in the river, and the water dissolves as mud camouflage. As the creature confronts Dutch, it removes its mask and plasma cannon to fight him hand to hand, having deemed him a worthy opponent. Despite being overpowered, Dutch attempts to goad the creature into a booby trap. It goes around, but Dutch triggers a trap anyway, crushing the creature with the trap's counterweight. Dutch almost kills it, but stops to ask it, "What the hell are you?" The creature repeats the question to him and activates its self-destruct device. Realizing what it has done, Dutch runs for cover and survives the explosion. He is then rescued by the extraction helicopter with Anna already safely on board, and they fly away as the movie ends. There's not much I can say about this movie that hasn't been said already in other podcasts and other reviews and shit like that, except that it's a sci-fi slash horror classic. And if you haven't seen it before, what the fuck are you listening to this podcast for? Go watch it now and come back and finish the rest of this podcast later. It has an amazing cast with, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger in it. And he does an excellent job, as does everybody else in the cast. And it's definitely one you need to see if you've never seen it before. And again, if you haven't seen it, what the fuck? Stop this podcast and go watch it right now. This had a budget of 15 to 18 million and brought in 98.3 million at the box office. And of course, spawned a bunch of sequels, merchandise, comic books, video games, all that kind of shit. IMDb gave this a 7.8 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes an 80%, Letterboxd a 4 out of 5, and I give it a 4.5 out of 5. Up next, we have 2005's Homecoming.
I remember the night the whole world went to hell. Someone out there, it was the night I first met Jane.
It's one of them.
I don't think so.
It's one of them!
Your son, Corporal Gordon Hofstadter, was killed in action.
I have the right to ask. Why did my son die?
If I had one wish, I would wish for your son to come back.
Sir? Stop! Please stop!
How can a dead soldier get up? The thing is, you can't kill him.
Based on the Dale Bailey short story, Death and Suffrage, this technically isn't a movie. It's actually the sixth episode from the first season of the Masters of Horror TV show. If you never saw it, you should definitely check it out. The entire series is fucking excellent. But anyway, this episode deals with President George W. Bush running for re-election during a divisive war. And one of his speechwriters, David Murch, goes on TV to speak with talk show host Marty Clark and Jane Cleavage. Another guest is Cindy Sheehan, like mother of a dead soldier, Janet Hofstadter, demands to know what her son died for. Murch gets a bit teary-eyed as he explains that he lost his older brother, Philip, in Vietnam. Believe me, he tells the grieving mom, if I had one wish, I would wish for your son to come back, because I know he would tell us how important this struggle is. Cleaver is so impressed with Murch's handling of the situation that she takes him out for a drink later, picks his brain, and eventually seduces him. The Carl Rove-like Kurt Rand interrupts their tryst, calling to let Murch know that the president plans to make his line part of his speech. Soon, the soldiers killed in Iraq actually do start returning from the dead. However, they are not back to feast on the living or even to get revenge on the president and his supporters. They just want a chance to vote in the upcoming election. We'll vote for anyone who ends this war, one explains. The spin machine goes into overdrive, but the dead are determined to make their voice heard, even going as far as one soldier killing Kurt Rand by acting out the Lucio Fulci zombie stereotype. Which is gouging his eye and slamming his head into the table when Rand tries to force him to sign an unwanted document by threatening the soldier's mother. While voting results are being counted during the election, people within the current administration decide to skew the results so the current administration remains in power. After the election results are broadcast, more soldiers begin to return from the dead, but not just ones from Iraq. Soldiers begin to return from previous wars, including World War I, and two, the Vietnam War and the Civil War. Eventually, all the people who died during wartime to protect the United States of America have returned from the dead. The progress of the movie also reveals a shadowy mistake from Murch's past. He believed that his brother Philip was murdered in the Vietnam War, only to discover that it was he who unintentionally killed him long ago with a gun in a game of friend or foe. After Cleaver attacks the soldiers with a shotgun, Murch kills her, but fails to kill himself. Murch is countered by a soldier that asks him to join them, saying, "We're looking for a few good men." Philip is among those returning from the grave, saying he forgives Murch for killing him, and then snaps Murch's neck. Now one of the zombies, Murch announces that he will show anyone who sends their brothers and sisters to die for a lie the truth, the true face of hell, and the movie ends. Now, this is one that gets a little too preachy for my taste. It's still a good episode from this excellent series, but it definitely leans more democratically than Republican, and there is a lot of Republican bashing in it. It also kind of spoofs, you know, how I'm not going to get political because that's not what this podcast is about, but it kind of spoofs how it has been proven that the Democrats have used people's names that have been dead for decades when it comes to voting and using it as a voting scam. But like I said, even though while this tends to get a little too preachy and anti-war for my taste, it's still a good episode with a good message. So if you can find it, definitely check it out. IMDb gave this a 6.1 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 55%. Letterboxd a 3 out of 5. And I give it a 3.5 out of 5. And that leads us into 2018's Overlord.
Ago, I was cutting grass in my front yard, and the mailman shows up with a letter from the army. Now I'm here. No idea where I'm gonna end up.
What happened here?
Some questions don't have good answers.
There's a lot of soldiers out there, and there's only 4 of us.
Find out what's inside that compound.
On the eve of D-Day, a paratrooper squad, most of them in an integrated unit, is sent to destroy a German radio jamming tower in an old church. Their plane is shot down and crashes, and most of the squad, including squad leader Sergeant Renson, are killed either in the crash or by Nazi soldiers and landmines. 4 survivors remain: Second-in-Command Corporal Ford, PFC Boyce, PFC Tibbet, and Private Chase. The team continues onward and meets Chloe, a young woman from the village where the church is located. She lets him take refuge in her house. Chloe lives with her 8-year-old brother Paul and her aunt, who has been disfigured by Nazi experiments taking place in the church. After Tippett and Chase depart to check the scheduled rendezvous site, a Nazi patrol led by SS Waffner visits Chloe. Waffner sends his men away and proceeds to coerce Chloe for sex, threatening to send her brother to the church to be fixed. Boyce cannot ignore this and interrupts a Nazi officer, and Ford is forced to follow suit and restrains Waffner. Attempting to reach the rendezvous point to look for Tippett and Chase, Boyce witnesses the Nazis burning disfigured village residents. He is then chased by a dog and forced to hide in a truck carrying dead bodies into the church. Sneaking out of the truck, Boyce discovers an underground base that houses not only a radio operating room, but also a laboratory where the Germans perform various experiments on the villagers involving a mysterious serum and a large pit filled with black tar. Boyce takes a syringe containing the serum and rescues Rosenfeld, another member of the paratrooper squad, who was captured alive. They escape through the base's sewers. When Boyce and Rosenfeld get back to Chloe's house, Tippett and Chase have already returned. Waffner refuses to explain what the serum does, even as Ford tortures him. As the squad prepares to attack the church, Waffner attempts to escape and fatally shoots Chase. Boyce, having seen a dead man supposedly resurrected by the serum in the lab, injects Chase with the syringe, and Chase is resurrected, but soon mutates and turns violent. A scuffle ensues, ending with Boyce bludgeoning Chase to death. A patrol responding to the carnage arrives, and the shootout erupts in which the patrol is killed, and Ford blows half of Waffner's face off. Waffner, however, escapes with Paul as a hostage, and back at the lab, injects himself with 2 doses of the serum. Boyce then proposes infiltrating the base and destroying the tower from the inside, which would also destroy the laboratory. The other privates support him, and Ford grudgingly agrees. Splitting up, Rosenfeld and Tippett launch a frontal assault as a distraction, while Ford, Boyce, and Chloe enter the base using the sewers. Boyce and Ford plant the explosives, while Chloe looks for Paul. Chloe then finds Paul, sends him back to the village, and successfully kills a mutated test subject who corners her. She then returns to the village, where Tippett and Rosenfeld are pursued by the base defenders. Tippett is wounded while shielding Paul from gunfire, and Chloe kills the remaining Germans and treats Tibbet's wounds. Waffner, now mutated and possessing superhuman strength and resilience, overpowers Ford and impales him on a meat hook. Waffner then reveals that the serum was made by using the villagers' bodies to distill the ancient power of the black tar, which had been running under the village for centuries. The aim was to create immortal and invincible soldiers to serve the Reich. As Boyce distracts Waffner, Ford pulls a hook out and injects himself with the serum to heal his wounds. He holds off Waffner long enough for Boyce to set off an oxygen tank, which sends Waffner falling in the tar pit. As he begins to mutate, Ford orders Boyce to leave him behind and detonate the explosives, believing neither side should possess the serum. Boyce complies and narrowly escapes as the church and jamming tower collapses behind him, killing Ford, Waffner, and the test subjects. He joins the others as the radio announces that the D-Day invasion concluded in a victory for the Allies. Later on in his report, Boyce credits Ford for the decision to plant the bombs inside the church. The commanding officer questions Boyce regarding rumors of an underground lab under the church. Boyce, sharing Ford's view, denies seeing anything worth digging up. The officer seemingly accepts his story and informs him that they will be reassigned to C Company as the war continues and the movie ends. While this got pretty decent reviews when it first came out, I am not a fan of this movie. I find it to be pretty fucking boring, to be completely honest. And my biggest problem with this movie is it can't decide if it wants to be a war movie or a horror movie. It doesn't give both genres equal time, I guess. And it just takes a really long time to get into the movie. At least it did for me. I always found my mind wandering off to better shit that I could think about while I was trying to watch this. It just couldn't hold my attention. And I just think it's just not a very good movie. This had a budget of $38 million, but was considered a flop as it only brought in $41 million at the box office. IMDb gave this a 6.6 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes an 81%, Letterboxd a 3.2 out of 5, and I give it a 2.2 out of 5. Next up, we have 2008's Outpost.
60 years ago, the war ended. But for 8 men,
we worked with mercenaries before.
So what is real story, huh, Tom?
Who unearthed the past?
An equation that could potentially alter reality. A soldier that was invulnerable, unstoppable.
The battle has just begun.
Bring it on.
They want soldiers. Let's give them soldiers.
They just did what they were trained to do. They killed. They're going to tear us to pieces here.
Ray Stevenson, Outpost.
In a city bar in a town ravaged by war, scientist and businessman Hunt hires former Royal Marine turned mercenary DC to assemble a crack team of ex-soldiers Pryor, Jordan, Cotter, Wojtek, McKay, and Taktarov to protect him on a dangerous journey into no man's land. Their mission is to scope out an old military bunker in Eastern Europe, likely in Kosovo. Wojtek, one of the mercenaries, claims that there is nothing important located in the area they are heading to. As the mercenaries approach their destination, they hear sounds of fighting off in the distance. Fighter jets pass overhead, and artillery can be heard as well. As they make their way through the woods, an intense burst of static knocks out their radio communications, and the mercenaries speculate as to what their job is and why they have been hired. Reaching their destination, the team discovers that the location is a seemingly abandoned bunker complex, leaving two of the mercenaries, Jordan and Taktarov, above ground to watch their backs. The rest of the team fans out and begins to explore the outpost. Above ground, Jordan notices a flash of light coming from the tree line. The two mercenaries assume that it is sunlight flashing off a scope and open fire, causing the rest of the team to come racing back up to the top. Another burst of static is heard over the team's radio, and suddenly radio operator McKay is wounded. DC soon realizes that it doesn't seem like anyone is actually out there, as the only shots fired in return was the one which wounded McKay. Taktarov, who had continued to fire after DC, ordered a halt is sent out into the tree line in order to check for a body or blood. He turns a minute later to report that there was no sign of a shooter, no bodies, no blood, not even shell casings to indicate anyone has been there. The mercenaries get back to work exploring the bunker. Despite it seemingly having been abandoned for decades, they discover a small modern metal crucifix necklace dangling in a forgotten corner of the bunker. Locating the bunker's generator, DC and Hunt get to work restoring the power. Connor and McKay discover a room filled with corpses and are horrified when an arm suddenly shoots up from the pile of corpses. They frantically call for Jordan, the team's medic, and DC leaves Pryor to protect Hunt while he and Jordan race to the scene and begin tending to the survivor goats. As the lights come on, Pryor discovers a room with a projector screen, lifting it up. A flag can be seen on the wall behind it. Pryor then slowly steps back, revealing the swastika on the flag, which is, of course, the emblem of the Nazi Party. The mercenaries begin interrogating Goetz, who is catatonic, with McKay being particularly demanding. The mercenaries assume that that local paramilitaries had used the bunker to hide the evidence of ethnic cleansing. Pryor shows them the Nazi flag he found, and Jordan suggests that there might be a stockpile of Nazi gold looted from the nations they conquered hidden in the bunker. DC orders the rest of the team to prepare defenses for a long stay, as they assume whoever shot at them earlier was likewise looking for gold. McKay then sets up a command post in a central room, propping Goetz up in a nearby chair, while Hunt begins to go through a set of documents. He then heads into a back room, where he discovers an odd spherical machine, which is an example of occult Nazi experiments. He reports his discovery to the ex-soldiers. Out of boredom, McKay sets up a chessboard on the table between himself and Goetz, going through a box full of personal effects. He discovers an old German coin. Dropping it, McKay reaches down to pick it back up, only to see the jack-booted legs of a pair of men standing right next to Goetz. Hurriedly throwing himself to the side, McKay readies his rifle, only for there to be no sign of the two men. DC wanders into the room to see McKay lying on the floor, and less than impressed, he sends McKay to try and get the radio working again. Hunt, meanwhile, is working in the room with the sphere. Over the shoulder, the form of an SS trooper can be seen stepping out of the shadows. A noise is heard in the background, and Hunt heads to the door but can't get it open. As he fiddles with it, the SS trooper suddenly looms up behind him, and heavy breathing can be heard. Hunt then spins around quickly, only for there to be nothing there again. He is angry, assuming that one of the mercenaries was playing a prank on him. He then fills DC in on the premise behind the sphere that it was a project carried out by the SS during World War II, using reality shifting and reanimation to create invincible soldiers. Sorry. Additional paranormal events continue to happen to the men in the outpost. McKay manages to get the original bunker radio equipment working, initially producing eerily scream-like static before suddenly switching to classical music. Despite unplugging the radio, McKay is unable to get it to stop functioning before it suddenly shuts itself off in a small explosion. And that's where I'm going to stop talking about this, because this movie gets incredibly fucking stupid. It starts out decent enough. Well, it actually starts out pretty good. But then just everything everybody does just gets dumber and dumber by the fucking minute. And it's hard to believe that real soldiers would do half of the shit that these people fucking do in this movie. It's just pretty unbelievable. Although I will say there are some good gore effects in this. And the zombie makeup is pretty fucking cool. So that is a redeeming point for this movie. Otherwise, it's just fucking stupid. This had, like, I think 4 or 5 sequels that followed, even though I'm not quite sure why. And I haven't seen any of the other ones, because this one was enough to disappoint me on its own. IMDb gave this a 5.8 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, 35%. Letterboxd, a 2.7 out of 5. And I give it a 1.5 out of 5. And next we have the truly god fucking awful 2005's Doom.
At a distant research facility, the final 10% of the human genome has just been discovered. And with it, all hell has broken loose. Now, a call for help has gone out.
Game time. Listen up, man. We're going in hot.
In a breeze, kill it.
There's something coming up behind you. It's in the sewer! What is that?
We gotta go now.
Evacuate! Evacuate!
I'm not even really going to talk about this fucking waste of fucking time movie, because that's exactly what it is. It's a fucking waste of time. I mean, it's not even worth anybody's watch. It falls into the same curse that every other video game movie adaptation falls into. For some reason, they always just fucking suck. They can't get the movie right to fit in with the game. Obviously, this is based on the classic video game of the same name. And this movie just fucking sucks. The CGI, the acting, the dialogue, and which is really kind of sad because Richard Brake is in this. And I really do like Richard Brake, but he is so over the top horrible in this movie it just completely lowers my respect for him as an actor. And of course it has The Rock in it, and he does a pretty horrible job of acting in this as well. It's just a movie that never should have been made and isn't worth a single watch. You'll fucking hate yourself for watching it. IMDb gave this a 5.2 out of 10. Unsurprisingly, Rotten Tomatoes gave it an 18%. Letterboxd gave it a 2 out of 5, and I give it a half a star out of 5. So that brings us to 1991's Child's Play 3.
Left, right. Welcome to Hell on Earth.
You are without a doubt the most pathetic thing I have ever seen.
Strict discipline.
Does this look like a gun to you, Barkley? It's a rifle.
Next, rigid dress codes.
Pisto, you're a ball.
Get those weapons in the air. I want to see them high.
And grueling drills. It couldn't possibly get any worse.
Wrong again, wimp.
Chucky's back. A few years have passed.
No, you're dead. He killed you.
I'm new and improved.
At Kent, we take bedwetters and turn them into men.
Andy, how you've grown. And this time, I really gotta get out of this body. He's looking for a new recruit.
I got some fresh meat lined up, and I'm not gonna let you spoil it.
Now, just think. Chucky's gonna be bro. Child's Play 3. Look who's stalking.
A haircut ain't regulation, soldier.
Regulate this!
Yeah. 8 years after the previous film, the Play Pals company resumes manufacturing good guy dolls and reopens the abandoned factory. A splash of blood from Chucky's corpse is inadvertently mixed in with the plastic being used to produce the dolls, reviving him in a new body. Chucky is then given to PlayPal CEO Mr. Sullivan, and Chucky strangles him to death, then uses computer records to locate Andy Barkley. Now 16, Andy has been sent to Kent Military Academy. Colonel Cochran, the school's commandant, advises Andy to forget his fantasies about the doll. And while there, Andy befriends cadets Harold Aubrey Whitehurst, Ronald Tyler, an 8-year-old cadet, and Kristen Da Silva, for whom he develops romantic feelings. He also meets Brett C. Shelton, a sadistic lieutenant colonel who routinely bullies the cadets. Tyler is asked to deliver a package to Andy's room, and Tyler realizes that the package contains a good guy doll after he trips and rips it open, and takes it to the cellar to open it. Chucky then bursts from the package and is pissed off to find Tyler instead of Andy, but remembering he can possess the first person who learns his true identity, tells Tyler his secret. Before Chucky can enact the ritual, however, Cochran interrupts them and confiscates the doll, throwing it into a garbage truck. Chucky escapes by luring the driver into the truck's compactor and crushes him. That night, Chucky attacks Andy and tells him his plans for taking over Tyler's body. Before Andy can fight back, Sheldon comes in and takes the doll away from him. Andy then sneaks into Sheldon's room to recover it, but Shelton awakens to confront him, only to find that Chucky has vanished. Suspecting the doll was stolen, Shelton forces all the cadets to do exercises as punishment. Chucky attempts to possess Tyler again, but they are once again interrupted by Da Silva and fellow cadet Ivers. Later, a knife-wielding Chucky surprises Cochran, unintentionally shocking him into a fatal heart attack. And the next morning, Andy tries to convince Tyler that Chucky is evil, but Tyler refuses to believe him. Meanwhile, Chucky kills the camp barber, Sergeant Botnick, by slashing his throat with a straight razor, which Whitehurst witnesses, and then flees. Despite Cochran's death, the school's annual war games are ordered to proceed as planned, with cadets divided between a red team and a blue team. Andy and Shelton are both on the blue team, and Chucky secretly replaces the paint bullets of the red team with live ammunition. When the simulation begins, Chucky gets Tyler away from his team, And finally realizing that Chucky is evil, Tyler stabs him with a pocket knife and flees to find Andy. Chucky then attacks Da Silva and holds her hostage, and Chucky forces Andy to exchange Tyler for Da Silva. The blue team and red team then arrive on the scene and open fire, and Shelton is killed by one of the bullets fired by the red team. However, this causes Tyler to be able to escape into the chaos, and Chucky tosses a grenade at the cadets, which Whitehurst leaps on top of, and sacrifices himself to save the others. Andy and Kristen then pursue Chucky and Tyler into a haunted house-themed roller coaster at a nearby carnival. Chucky kills a security guard, kidnaps Tyler, and then shoots Kristen in the leg, leaving Andy to fight him alone. Andy is able to stop Chucky from finishing the ritual to possess Tyler, and after a prolonged struggle, Chucky is mutilated with Tyler's pocket knife and then thrown into a massive metal fan that is part of the attraction, shredding him to pieces and finally killing him. Later, Andy is taken away by the police for questioning while Da Silva is rushed to the hospital as the carnival closes down, and the movie ends. I've made my feelings about this second sequel in this franchise quite well known on previous episodes, like when me and Jerry did a rundown on the entire franchise back in the third season, or maybe it was the beginning of this fourth season. I don't know. I don't fucking remember. And I did a separate episode on Chucky himself back in like the second season, I want to say, but I'm not completely positive. I don't know. Go back and fucking look for yourselves. I think this is the dumbest entry in the, well, one of the dumbest entries in this franchise, although not the dumbest. And just, it's a stupid movie. I mean, first of all, Alex Vincent isn't playing Andy in this. They have a different Andy for this. And I mean, it's just a stupid movie. A lot of things in it don't make any sense. If you want to know what I'm talking about, either watch the movie or go back and listen to those past episodes where I go into more detail about it. It's just not a good movie. I mean, it's slightly better than the next two that would follow it, though it's being Bride of Chucky and Seed of Chucky. But it's just an overall low point for the franchise. However, this did become a quite controversial film in the UK when it was suggested that it might have inspired the real-life murders of British children James Bulger and Suzanne Caper, based on suggestions that were made by the arresting officers, only because in both cases, a receipt for a video rental was found shortly before the murders, and one of the movies that was running was Child's Play 3, which really doesn't have any basis for these real-life tragedies, but that's just what was used as, I don't even know how to say it, but it was just stupid all around. But yeah, the accusations really had no basis, I guess, is the best way to put it. IMDb gave us a 5.1 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes at 23%, Letterboxd at 2 out of 5, and I give it a 2.2 out of 5. And that leads us into the final film, and that is 1997's Starship Troopers.
Entire area, you kill anything that has more than two legs, you get me?
We
an enemy more devastating than any ever imagined.
Based on the classic 1959 science fiction novel by Robert A. Heinlein of the same name, this movie takes place in the 21st century. While colonizing new planets, humans have encountered a hostile non-technological insectoid species known as arachnids, but commonly referred to as bugs. The bugs appear to be little more than savage, unrelenting killing machines, though there are suggestions that they were provoked by the intrusion of humans into their own habitats. In the United Citizens Federation, citizenship is earned by performing activities such as military service, which grants individuals opportunities prohibited to basic civilians. After graduating from high school in Buenos Aires, Johnny Rico, his girlfriend Carmen Ibanez, and psychic best friend Carl Jenkins enlist in the Federal Service despite Rico's parents' disapproval of military service. Carmen becomes a spaceship pilot while Carl joins military intelligence, and Rico enlists in the mobile infantry and surprisingly finds that Isabel Dizzy Flores, his former classmate who also has romantic feelings for him, has deliberately transferred to his squad. In mobile infantry basic training, career sergeant Zim ruthlessly trains the recruits. Rico befriends fellow cadet Ace Levy and is later promoted to squad leader. He subsequently receives a Dear John letter from Carmen as she desires a career with the fleet and now serves under Rico's high school sports rival Xander Barklow. Following a live fire training incident that kills one of Rico's squad members and causes another to quit out of guilt, Rico is demoted and flogged. He resigns and calls his parents to ask them if he can return home, but rescinds his resignation after an asteroid reported to have been launched by the arachnids obliterates Buenos Aires, killing his parents and millions of others. An invasion force is deployed to Klindathu, the arachnids' home planet, but the operation severely underestimates the arachnids and it is a total disaster. Rico is severely wounded and mistakenly reported killed in action, and after recovering, he, Ace, and Dizzy are reassigned to the Roughnecks, an elite unit commanded by Lieutenant Gene Rezek, Rico's former high school teacher. He quickly gains the respect of his peers and is promoted to the rank of corporal after destroying a tanker bug. His relationship with Dizzy continues to grow, and they have sex during their night on Tango Urilla. The Roughnecks respond to a distress called from Planet P, where they reconnect an outpost that has been devastated by bugs. They soon realize that the distress call was a trap, and the arachnids swarm the outpost. Rico, now an acting sergeant, euthanizes a mortally wounded Razik after a buried tanker bug bites off his legs. Dizzy is killed, but Carmen and Xander rescue the surviving Roughnecks. At Dizzy's funeral, Rico and Carmen encounter Carl, now a high-ranking intelligence officer, and revealing that there is a reason to believe an intelligent brain bug is directing the other bugs and has been learning how to fight humans. Carl field promotes Rico to lieutenant and gives him command of the Roughnecks, ordering the mobile infantry units under his control to return to P in an attempt to capture the brain bug. The fleet encounters unexpected heavy fire from the bugs, and Carmen's ship is destroyed. Carmen and Xander's escape pods crash into a bug tunnel system near Rico. They are surrounded by bugs, and a brain bug uses its proboscis to pierce Xander's skull and eat his brain. As it is about to do the same to Carmen, she cuts off its proboscis with a knife, and Rico, Watkins, and Ace arrive and threaten the bugs with a small nuclear bomb, which the brain bug recognizes. They flee while the brain bug escapes, and arachnids pursue them, and Watkins, mortally wounded, sacrifices himself by detonating the bomb to enable the others to escape. After returning to the surface, they find that former Sergeant Zim, who had requested a demotion to private so he could serve at the front, has captured the brain bug. Carl tells Rico and Carmen that the humans will soon be victorious now that military intelligence can study the brain bug. Carl mentally scans the bug and reveals that it is afraid, and the troops rejoice. A propaganda clip then shows Carmen, Ace, and Rico as model servicemen, encouraging the viewers to enlist in the armed forces as the movie ends. When I was a kid, I used to fucking love this movie. I thought it was great. But upon, you know, later watches as I got older, I realized that this really isn't that good of a movie. The acting is, it's kind of all over the place, depending on the actors. Some do a good job, some do a bad job, and some just fucking suck ass. The CGI for the bugs is pretty bad, and they kind of make the bugs look more like the creatures from Tremors than they do than how I think Henleyan tried to picture them to be. But this all around isn't as good of a movie as I once thought it was. It's not as terrible as some movies I've talked about on this podcast. It's definitely a B-movie, even though it's a higher budget B-movie. But it's really just not that great of a movie. It's tolerable, and it's entertaining enough. But there are some boring parts that kind of drag on when they don't need to. But it's just an alright movie. This had a budget of $100 to $105 million and brought in $121.2 million at the box office. IMDb gave this a 7.3 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 66%, Letterboxd a 2.8 out of 5, and I give it a 2.5 out of 5. And I do have some honorable mentions for this episode. They're honorable mentions because they're movies I've already talked about in past episodes, so I wasn't going to rehash them again. And those honorable mentions are Uncle Sam, Dog Soldiers, Aliens, Alien 3, Day of the Dead, Dead Snow, and Dead Snow 2. And that just about wraps it up, guys. As always, you can reach me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you next time.